Cinephile. Nicolas Cage.
Very sincere group of film enthusiasts who are proudly cinephiles.
Oh my goodness! Warren Beatty apparently read the wrong name. This is incredible! Moonlight won Best Picture!
Cinephile. Ethan Hawke.
It's kind of like I'm a professional actor and I direct for love. There's so much in this world that's dividing us, and music is one of those great tools that brings us together.
Paul Rudd.
There's baseball and World War II. It's kind of a dream.
Cinephile, the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast.
All right, yes. Why wasn't I still recording?
That would have been gold.
Gonna run that as the open.
Very true. Very quick on the trigger. Thanks to Randy Moore putting that together here on Cinephile. Brand new open. Those were our stories from Sundance. Thanks to all those who listened the last couple of times for all those Sundance stories. Normally I would begin with a review from a critic, but I had to open with this. Who is this from, you ask? Marvel's Black Panther is a masterpiece of movie making, a film that succeeds on multiple levels, touching hearts and opening minds, all while entertaining millions of people and far exceeding the loftiest box office projections. This groundbreaking movie opened to a record-breaking $242 million in domestic box office over the holiday weekend and delivered the second highest four-day opening in movie history. That's not from Peter Travers, it's from Bob Iger, Disney president, sending that to all of us. Yes! Black Panther! Who cares? I only gave it 2.5 Maple Leafs. Go see it again! Our 401k skyrocketing thanks to Ryan Coogler's masterpiece, Black Panther, in theaters now. As always, help us out. Go to iTunes and please give Cinephile a review. I rank my movies at a 4 Maple Leafs. You can rank it at a 5 stars. And then please write some reviews. I try to read them all. I appreciate all of you do them. Rick Pashper passed on a couple here. Beantown 33, fun and sincere. Nice to get a podcast that isn't cynical or seeming to be fake and snobbery. Adnan clearly loves films, gives you a great feel for the movie without taking 30 minutes to do it. Definitely worth subscribing to. Thank you, sir. And Jen 1976, entertaining and passionate. One of the few hosts I could take on my beloved Mike and Mike show. Okay, I'll scroll to that part. I just listened to the first three episodes of Cinephile. They're excellent, good mix of personal stories, discussion of actors, lifetime works, and new movie reviews. His passion for movies is clear. So thanks so much for those reviews. As Dan had previously suggested, review each segment if you like. Just my understanding is the more you review, the more it helps us out. Subscribe, unsubscribe, and then resubscribe. It's not only my dream coming true here, going to the Oscars for the second time, but also Dan Stanzig, we can officially say we'll be along for the party. Did you get a tux yet? You're going to be there.
Yeah, blacktux.com. Never worn a tux in my life. Kind of excited, I guess. I don't know. Yeah, what do I need to know? Give me the how-to.
I was going to say, I don't think you're alone, because I'm with you on that. I had never bought a tux prior to last year as well, and I'm 7 years older than you. So, listen, it's going to be an unbelievable event. The biggest thing, as I told you last year, you just can't have your phone. Like, it's going to be so weird. You just want to be able to take pictures, stream, video, and they're like, no. Like, there's Oscar police there. But you're going to have a whale of a time. You're going to a wedding, so you're already going to be in California.
Yeah, wedding about 100 miles east of L.A. in Palm Springs. I thought that was in Florida. It's in the L.A. area. Who knew?
Nice.
Yeah, so then I'll drive there, get my credential on Friday, drive back there Sunday, and see what happens.
So the next Cinephile you're going to hear, it's going to be me, Dan, and Ben Lyons from the Kodak Theater. We're going to knock one out as if it's literally the Oscars ends. Here's 10 minutes, and then we'll do more after that. So looking forward to that, and Dan's first time on the red carpet. Passmore, we'll get you hooked up next year. Reviews of films coming up. Roman J. Israel, Girls Trip. My man Max Bredos, who is thankfully staying with ESPN, but he's going out to L.A. So one of the last few times he's going to be here in Connecticut. He loves movies. He also does unbelievable impressions. So he's going to stop by as well. And we saw all the shorts. If you're a real movie lover, all the shorts, I saw them all. Live action, all the ones that are nominated for the Academy Award. Live action, animation, and documentary shorts. Passmore, I think, has seen all of them as well.
All but documentary. Have all not but documentary. Watched documentaries
and, yet. And Dan also saw animation. And so this is great. This is ideally what it is. All of us can see it. We can all banter together which ones we liked, which ones we didn't like. All that more coming up. Scorsese's masterclass. Hours upon hours. For me, it was a rapturous symphony. He goes through every part of the business of filmmaking, whether it's cinematography, whether it's editing, whether it's working with actors, whether it's marketing your film. It's absolutely invaluable and indispensable. If you're a wannabe filmmaker, you have to take it. If you just love movies, if you're a cinephile like me, you should take it. If you just love Scorsese and just like the way he talks and his staccato delivery, then you should take it. Energy upon energy and so much insight from the master. Rather than me go through every section, what we'll do is this. Dan and Ricky, you guys just give me a Scorsese movie and I'll give you a story or two that he tells about that film. Ricky, which one would you like first?
Let's start with the biggest one, Goodfellas.
So Goodfellas, the best story he tells from Goodfellas is this, which I did not know. He said when he was growing up, he always thought that they played the music on set.
Because he goes, he loved those Westerns as a kid, right? When he was a kid, he would go with his mom or his dad, and he goes, oh, I love Duel in the Sun. He always talks about Duel in the Sun. And, of course, he loves The Searchers, which in many ways was a template for Taxi Driver. But Marty goes, when I would watch these movies, especially the ones in the 60s, I thought that they had, like, music playing, and I thought it was so orchestrated. And I was amazed when I found out, no, they do that in post. So he said, with a movie like Mean Streets, you know, I had so much music in there. I go, I wish that Harvey could hear the Ronettes when we're shooting it. So on Goodfellas, specifically for that Layla sequence, he goes, when you start to see all the bodies pop up, I specifically said, you have to have the music playing because I want my camera operators and Michael Bauhaus, who's the director of photography, I want the dolly to completely track along with the music. It has to fit the notes. So this is not, he goes, oftentimes I hear filmmakers say, we shot it and then found the music. He goes, no, for me, I always have the music in my head. Specifically when De Niro, that scene where Sunshine of Your Love is playing, he's smoking the cigarette when he knows he's going to kill Maury. He goes, that's another time I knew I had to have that song. And when we were editing it, we just saw a little flicker, a little gleam in Bob's eye. And we said, if we really slow it down, it's really going to hit with that guitar riff. So Goodfellas, he said, for many ways for me, it was like this orchestrated music video. And he said, the biggest key for me was having Layla playing on set while we were shooting it and Sunshine of Your Love, crafting it to De Niro's movements and knowing exactly what speed to shoot it at with the slow motion. That to me was very interesting.
All right, you know where I'm going with this. Just for my cousin Colin and his wife Meg, big fans of the podcast. She's pregnant, by the way.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations to Meg and Colin. Shutter Island.
There's almost zero mention of Shutter Island.
All right, Hugo.
It's very clear which movies Marty cares most about, okay? There's a lot of Mean Streets. There's a lot of Goodfellas. There's a lot of Raging Bull. There's a lot of Taxi Driver. There is zero mention of The Color of Money. There is zero mention of Kundun. There is zero mention of those documentaries I've been reviewing recently. Shutter Island, he only tells one story, which is that he just how much he loves Ben Kingsley. So this will dovetail into Hugo as well, which he doesn't talk about much either. He just said how Ben Kingsley is the type of actor that once he kind of figures out the outside, the inside comes easily. So he said with Hugo, Georges Méliès, like we knew his films, but I didn't know much about him. You see a picture. But he goes, Ben just kind of knew the way the mustache and the look of it felt right. He goes, similarly, the psychologist in Shutter Island, he knew how to play that character, and he's the type of actor that sets the tempo. Because I found that on both those movies, Kingsley set the tempo. So Leo and Ruffalo and all the other actors in Shutter Island were kind of following Kingsley's lead. And he goes, it's interesting as a director, you're the master conductor, but actors, you also need somebody who's like the alpha male. Like there's the actor everyone looks to. It's like Paul Thomas Anderson said about Phantom Thread. He goes, you know, to Vicky Krebs, what's it like working with Daniel Day-Lewis? Well, Daniel's Daniel. Like, you know, he's a stud. Like, he has presence. So you get a rise to him. That's all he says about Ben Kingsley and Shutter Island. Sorry, Colin. I wish there was more. It's not one of Marty's favorites. Ricky, which one for you?
The Aviator.
Aviator, he talks about, it's interesting. Again, he said the sequences that, you know, he'd always wanted to shoot, like, movies about movies. So he said it was really interesting having to shoot that stuff, you know, when Leo's making Hell's Angels and Howard Hughes is wrapped up. And he goes, that for me was a ton of fun. And also that crash sequence, you know, Spielberg's one of his closest friends. And he goes, I always wished I could do like a Spielberg sequence. He goes, like, I could never do E.T. or Jurassic Park. I don't know how to do those movies. He said, so that crash, though, he really kind of thought, you know, how would Spielberg do it? And I think he solicited Spielberg's help a little bit with how to edit it and shoot it and put it all together. So The Aviator, he said, particularly the crash sequence and just from he loves that time period. He really loves history, which is clearly why he's made so many period pieces, especially of late. That's what his thoughts were on The Aviator.
All right. What about The King of Comedy, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull? Let's just knock those out.
All right. So King of Comedy is really interesting because he said, you know, this was De Niro's passion project. And again, they kind of had to work from the outside in. They couldn't figure out what the guy looked like. They knew who these guys were because at that point, they were big stars after Raging Bull. And obviously, they'd made Taxi Driver and Mean Streets. So Bob and Marty both knew what celebrity culture was like. But they go, who are these people who call our assistants? Who are these people who send in these notes? And they said they were with the costume designer. They're walking the streets of New York, I think around 42nd Street, and they saw a mannequin. And he goes, and De Niro hit him. He goes, oh, my God, that's Rupert Pupkin. And he said, oh, wow. And he goes, the exact outfit. Like, literally, they went to the store. They go, we want everything. Like, no, I want the jacket. I want the tie. I want the face. Like, he goes, they knew the exact way Bob wanted the mustache. He goes, the mustache is a little bit longer on one side than the other, just like the mannequin. That's critical. And he goes, that jacket, that's what Rupert's going to wear when he kidnaps Jerry Lewis and goes on his talk show. And the bow tie and the hair, he goes, oh, my God, it's perfect. And he goes, it was such a moment of synchronicity that they knew they had the character once they had the look of him in The King of Comedy. Taxi Driver, two good ones. That great tracking shot after Travis obliterates everybody, it took them, he said, 2 to 3 months, the tenement buildings, because this was right where New York was starting to get a little gentrified. So he goes, we didn't have to search for squalor, but you could feel it start to shift. And he says, so that tenement building was particularly woeful and just being torn down. And just to construct it, like, you know, that's a very exquisite overhead tracking shot. He said it took like 2 months just to finally get it orchestrated and figure out how to block it. And the day of, because there was shooting challenges and budget and they had something else to do, they had 45 minutes to get a very difficult tracking shot. And he repeats it to the audience in this masterclass. He goes, 2 months of work and we've got 45 minutes to get the shot. And he goes, thankfully we got it in two takes. But he goes, that's the pressure of filmmaking. That's what happens. You think you've got all the time in the world and all of a sudden they did. No, go. You got to get it now and that's it. Speak now, forever hold your peace. Because the producer's always there on set. The budgets, we got to go. And you're going, oh my God. But thank you, was able to work out. The other thing I really loved about Taxi Driver, he said, we weren't sure how to market it. How in the world do you market this movie? He said, when people would ask us about it, Bob and I could never explain what we loved about it. We just said we feel a real connection to it. When Paul Schrader was asked, why'd you write the script? He would explain it was like a caged animal. It just came out of me. Because I had no money. I was sleeping in my car. My wife had left me. I was very sick. I was in the hospital. And that's where this metaphor came with this taxi cab as a metaphor for loneliness. And he goes, I literally hunkered down for 10 days. I wrote the entire script. So they're asking De Niro and Marty, well, how do we sell this? It's about a young man and loneliness and urban alienation. Like, how do you sell that? And one of the studio people, Marty, this is the thing, people try to discredit the studio people. They know. He goes, that's the shot. They were going through pictures and the shot is the poster of Taxi Driver. And it's of De Niro walking down the street in New York with his head down. And they've got like the XXX theater in the back. And it's just a New York street. And Marty and Bob were like, well, how is that going to sell anything? It's just a shot of Bob walking down the street. And he goes, no, that's a really powerful image. And he goes, sometimes you can't use the words why, but you can just, you know, picture's worth 1,000 words. You go, that's a powerful image. People are going to see that poster and go, that's interesting. I'd like to see more of that. And they were stunned. They go like, no, it's just Bob standing on a street. I don't get it. And he goes, but it really sold the movie. He said, we got tests back afterwards and people said, well, I heard a little bit about it. Yeah, I heard of Mean Streets a little bit. Oh, De Niro won an Oscar for Godfather 2, but I love that poster. And then the tagline is a great one. It's one of my favorites. On every city, on every street, there's a nobody who dreams of being a somebody. So you put that line with that poster and all of a sudden it sold it. He goes, it's one of the biggest shocks in my career that Taxi Driver was a box office hit. Because when Schrader called me that night, because they're around the block in New York, I said, what? This movie's going to make money? He's like, yeah, seriously. Raging Bull, biggest thing people always wonder, why is it in black and white? He said at the time they were very concerned about color restoration. And he was watching an old boxing movie with Michael Powell, his dear friend, who did the Red Shoes, Powell and Pressburger. And he said they were looking at some dailies of De Niro, and he goes, the color's off. The red's not the right red. And he goes, Marty, you can't make a boxing movie, and you're showing vintage stuff in the 1950s, and people are going to say, but the red is off. The red doesn't look right. And he goes, whenever you think about stuff from that era, it's always in black and white. So you might as well just shoot it in black and white. And he goes, okay, maybe I'll just shoot the boxing scenes in black and white. Everything else is color. He goes, no, anytime if you put it in black and white, you think of vintage newsreel boxing, that's black and white. If you think of this guy in this tenement building, it's going to be black and white. Just go the whole thing. And the studio was very averse, as you can imagine. They go, black and white. Like, black and white movies do not market well. Like, people are not fired up to go watch the latest black and white movie at the multiplex in 1980. He said, but it was because he was worried about the color restoration and film preservation is a huge pet project of Scorsese's career. And it was because the gloves were off that's why he felt so impassioned he had to do it. And he goes, I couldn't imagine that movie in color. Critical decision. Thankfully, the studio agreed with him on it. I had to watch Roman J. Israel because Denzel Washington is nominated for Best Actor, and it is a mess. Like, what a terrible movie. I saw it while I was in Hollywood shooting that stuff for the Oscars All Access. And they said to me, hey, you've seen all the films, right? And I said, I've seen all the Best Picture nominees. I've seen all the acting nominees. I got one left. You want to take a guess? I go, Roman J. Israel, and it's playing at 2:30 at the Arclight, which is in Hollywood. They go, all right. I said, so tomorrow I'll be fully prepped. And it's terrible. Like, it's not even, no, I said to the guy when I'm buying the ticket, I go, you know what I'm doing here? I go, he goes, what's that? I go, I've seen all the nominees. This is the last one for me. I go, how bad is this movie? He goes, listen, some people didn't like it, but most people agree Denzel Washington's really good. I said, yeah? He goes, yeah. I go, because Rotten Tomatoes got it 50%. That's like critics. And then the audience is bad. I don't think anything's going to be good. He goes, well, if you have that approach, I go, no, listen, I'm open-minded. I'm just telling you, I don't think it's going to be a good movie. And here's the thing with Denzel, because that's what he walked in. He goes, what do you think? He goes, Denzel was good, right? I go, no. I said, no. The movie, first of all, is a mess. And I love Dan Gilroy. Nightcrawler is a great movie. But it's all over the place in terms of tone. One, I thought it was set in the 70s. Just by his look and costume and musical choices, no, it's current day. Because midway through, he says to the girl that he's attracted to, I called you an Uber. I go, wait, this movie's set in present day? And he knows how to do Uber? This guy does? And I'm stuck in Park City, Utah. I don't know how to do it. This high-functioning guy? Like, really? Okay. And secondly, I think this is what happens. The Academy goes, all right, Denzel Washington is obviously a tremendous actor. Of course, he's one of the great actors of all time. But they love when actors do something different. So he's got a wig. Oh, his character's high functioning. He's on the spectrum, a little bit of autism. Okay. Underdog, glasses, clothes, put on weight for the role. Like all these things are attractive to the Academy because they say, okay, it's an actor not doing what his usual thing is. And as Passmore and I will continue to contend, although Scott Feinberg challenges me on this because he says a lot of the voting was already done for best actor by the time Franco's sexual harassment allegations came out. So he doesn't think that that hurts him as much as you think. But I still think Me Too obviously had an impact on Franco not getting the nomination. But then why not Hanks getting nominated for The Post? Who, as Dan pointed out, I thought he was fine. And when I talked to Rebecca Keegan of Vanity Fair, she goes, he hasn't been nominated for 17 years. He was snubbed for Captain Phillips. He's a really good actor. Like, if you just do want to get Franco in there, The Post is a really good movie. Why couldn't they just nominate Tom Hanks? And I'm like, I don't know. If I'm Hanks and I watch Roman J. Israel, I'm like, are you kidding? The ending is laugh out loud bad. It is laughably bad how they try to solve this movie. Colin Farrell's in it. I had no idea Colin Farrell was in the movie. Ostensibly, he's this lawyer who's trying to fight the good fight. But I'm telling you, watch The Verdict. Watch A Few Good Men. Watch a bunch of other stuff. It was a bad movie. Roman J. Israel. 1.5 Maple Leafs. Having said that, here's a surprise for you. Girls Trip was terrific. We talked to Malcolm Lee, the director, on the podcast last summer, and I saw it on the flight out to Los Angeles. The way back, I saw Atomic Blonde. On the way out there, I saw Girls Trip. Hilarious. And I don't know how much they edit these movies for the plane, but thank God, you know, I had the headphones and the person next to me didn't seem offended by it, because it is a hard R. Like, if you'll recall, we asked Malcolm, because I'd seen some of the reviews, and I said, this movie, apparently, you're pushing the envelope. He's like, oh, yeah. And the scene stealer is Tiffany Haddish. She is fantastic. My friend Claire Atkins said it's like Melissa McCarthy in Bridesmaids. It's the perfect comp. Hilarious. I don't know her work. Apparently, she's great at stand-up. Apparently, Paul Thomas Anderson said he loved the film and he wants to work with her. And now the latest story I read is Tiffany Haddish is going to be in P.T. Anderson's movie at some point. Awesome. She's amazing. She steals the entire movie. Scatological humor. Very profane. Very vulgar. I can only tell you there's a scene. They all go to New Orleans for this girls' trip. And I can tell you, there's a scene where they're ziplining, which is one of the filthiest scenes I've seen in a while, and also one of the funniest, as I was laughing on the airplane. Girls Trip, 3 Maple Leafs, a surprisingly very funny movie, and female empowerment, other themes like that as well. But honestly, I'm just here for the jokes, and it more than delivered in that respect. Let's fire through some documentaries. Icarus is fantastic. It's currently available on Netflix. It tells the story of Brian Fogel, a documentarian who is a cyclist, and he's just curious about the impact of performance-enhancing drugs. So he wants to take some PEDs to see how it'll impact his performance. And he gets hooked up with a guy named Grigory Rodchenkov, who is a Russian doctor who is quite boastful about the fact he's been involved with Russian doping for years. I'm sure I can help you out. I can get you some good stuff. And so the story, you think, is about just how PEDs can influence an athlete. And then it takes a drastic right turn, and it ends up being a story about Rodchenkov, how he ends up being implicated in these Russian doping scandals, and that's why now we have the Olympic athletes from Russia, not Team Russia. And Rodchenkov is a mastermind of all this Russian doping that was going on for decades and is now a whistleblower, and he's calling out Putin and all these people, and now you've got a really dramatic, tense movie. So I love a documentary that completely upends your expectations, and that's what Icarus does. I give it 3.5 Maple Leafs. I thought it was terrific. Dan, I tossed the floor to you. What did you think of Icarus?
I don't have much more to say. I thought it was really good. I thought it was really interesting. Like you said, I had been told the premise of this guy who was a cyclist, and it turns into this whole, he blew the lid off the Russian doping thing.
Right.
It's crazy. I mean, it just takes you step by step how he did it with these athletes, and it's a relevant story to today when you still have a Russian curler who's tested positive for PEDs. It is totally worth your time, even if you're not a documentary fan, which I am not a big documentary guy.
Yeah.
But it's really, really well done.
Rodchenkov, a fascinating central character, because he comes across as kind of oafish, kind of goofy. He's playing with the dogs, what's your dog's name? And then he becomes a very tragic character. You see the fact when he's FaceTiming with his wife and kids, he's not sure if he's ever going to see them again.
He's shirtless a lot, too. I'll warn everybody out there. Oddly shirtless for most of the movie.
Which I would argue makes him a little more likable as well, because he just doesn't care that he's not nearly as sculpted as these athletes who he's making perform at a high level. But yeah, really good movie. One that was disappointing is called Abacus. That's from Steve James. I'm so happy Steve James is up for an Oscar. You're wondering who's that? He's the guy who did Hoop Dreams, who was memorably snubbed. That movie came out in 1994, the best basketball movie I've ever seen, one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. And this movie, Abacus, is about a small Chinese-American bank, which was one of the few banks with all the malfeasance which occurred with all the financial institutions. This is one of the few that was actually prosecuted for crimes. And so James really stacks the deck in their favor and points out the fact that the prosecution is being very xenophobic and, quite frankly, racist, and the fact they're targeting this Chinese-American bank, and all the big American banks escape any sort of wrath. And, in fact, the film argues that these people were very naive to what was going on and were not actually corrupt. It sounds a lot more interesting than it is. It's an awfully dry documentary. My buddy Mark Simon, who loves documentaries, also messaged me. He was very disappointed. I'm only going to give it 2 Maple Leafs. I would be stunned if it wins. I think Icarus is going to win the documentary feature. There's no chance Abacus Small Enough to Jail will win. Like I said, it's a good premise, and it sounds good, but the movie really stacks the deck, and there's just not much dramatic or narrative involvement. Also, Last Men in Aleppo is up for Best Documentary Feature. That's about the White Helmets. If you recall, last year, one of the shorts was about the White Helmets. Those are the rescue groups in Syria. Last Men in Aleppo is heartbreaking. It's an awfully tough watch. The movie, the first 10 minutes, it shows 3 babies being rescued from the rubble in Syria, 2 of which are alive, one of which is dead. So it's a very tough film to watch, but obviously a very important film to watch because this is clearly ongoing, and the White Helmets deserve, I think, all the acclaim and immense sacrifice that they're doing to try to help out their fellow citizens and rescue all these people. It doesn't have necessarily a strong narrative focus. It's more of a cinema verite documentary. You're just showing what these people do and what their daily lives are like, how to survive in a war-torn country when your own government is turning against you and the insurgents and the militia and who to trust and who not to, and ultimately being altruistic and trying to help others. Last Men in Aleppo, a very good documentary. Does have a chance, I think, maybe winning. I'll give it 3 Maple Leafs, and that's currently available as well. Now, as promised, our man Max Bredos, or is it Sean Connery showing up? So we were really excited to get Max Bredos in here. He's one of my closest friends. He does a phenomenal job for ESPN, but somehow, I don't know how he did this. I mean, our bookers are unbelievable. Carlton Gillespie's so good. Sean Connery is joining us right now here on Cinephile. Sean, thank you so much for coming on today.
Hurry up. I got a 9:30 tea time.
Well, yeah, don't worry. I'll make it quick.
I appreciate that. Got places to go, people to see, ladies to meet, martinis to shake, or stir.
Sean, I'll start with this. I love the Untouchables.
I'm a little bit tired. I just took the Concorde from Glasgow. Just so you know, I could use a few winks.
I'll make this quick for you.
Strong Turkish coffee.
I promise you. Listen, The Untouchables is one of my favorite movies. God, I love it. David Mamet's script, Brian De Palma directing.
I don't remember that.
No, but I guess they maybe weren't. De Palma's right. Maybe Mamet wasn't allowed on set. But listen, here endeth the lesson, and, that's the Chicago way. There's so many great lines of dialogue.
Racine Avenue. I know someone who lives there.
Can you just give me some of those lines from The Untouchables, yeah. Sean? The way you did it was so good.
Well, I don't want to offend anyone. There's a lot of profanity.
Well, there's one line he goes,
I don't want to make fun of the Italian listeners of Cinephile.
No, there's one line he goes, this town stinks like a whorehouse at night.
Yes, it does, Chicago. Smells like a Todd's handkerchief. Well, appropriately. It's an awful smell. I try to retain it because everything that comes out of my mouth could be viewed as a bit insensitive to one group or the other.
Well,
it smells like a Bombay sewer, you know. It's
my producer Dan loves The Rock. What can you tell me about Nicolas Cage and working with him and Michael Bay?
Nicolas Cage is he's an okay actor. Constantly late on set, at least as late as I was. Interesting hairpiece, and I'm not going to be.
No,
I'm not going to be judgmental because that's all I wear. I had to wear the A League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which how that did not get nominated is an absolute farce. So Nicolas Cage is a real pro, and he was there when I came up with the line, "Welcome to the Rock."
Yeah. Last one for you, Sean. What do you think of Daniel Craig as the new Bond?
Who the heck is that? Daniel Craig. I knew a Patrick Craig. He used to be a left back for Rangers Football Club. Averages best. Right footer playing left back. It doesn't make any sense. So I told the manager, pushed him to right midfield.
It's the best impression going. Max Bredos as Sean Connery. You can follow Max on Twitter. Yeah, thanks for the time, Sean. Appreciate it.
Oh, yes.
We'll get Max back in here now.
M. Titanic!
M. Bredos, ESPN. We have so much to talk about.
I can be me now?
No, I was going to say, now you can be you again. You're staying with ESPN, which is the good news. First and foremost, a lot of tweets that people go, wait, Max is leaving. No, he's leaving
Connecticut. I need to clear that up immediately.
He's leaving Connecticut. He's staying with ESPN. First, tell us what you're doing. I want to get that.
Okay, first of all, I'd say you'd be crazy to leave ESPN. This channel is going to be doing great things ahead. I want to be part of it. Yeah. I'm not towing the company line. With the ESPN Plus service, that's a big part. So what happened was, you know, sports is going to be changing here. We're looking forward to the Greenberg show. And I think there's things where you could kind of look at where you could play your strengths. So there's a new MLS team, LAFC, an incredible ownership group. Now, MLS is not Major League Baseball. It's not the Lakers. It's not the Dodgers. So they don't have a big TV presence. Most MLS teams don't. But they have this new incredible partnership with YouTube where they want to create content. So in addition to being the broadcaster, I could awesome. Help do the YouTube content. So that's exciting. I'll be head of creative content. That sounds frightening because me responsible for stuff. And if LFC's listening to, I'm just putting on
a
face.
Friend,
Tom Penn, Will Ferrell, Mia Hamm.
Awesome.
Magic Dude. Johnson, Peter Guber, the big TV executive.
Yeah.
I mean, he's going to be, so I'm looking forward to meeting those guys. So I'll do that. And
calling matches?
I'll be calling matches. Right. We'll do pre and post. We'll right. do shows. We'll have community outreach. I'm excited because LA's my home. I'm from Miami, but LA's my home. I spent 15 years there. And then I'll be working for ESPN out of the LA, whatever they need. And ESPN International, I'm already doing a bunch of stuff.
So you
you're getting bored as I keep on this.
You could be on the jump.
I'm going to ask to be on the jump.
That's unbelievable.
I'm going to talk to Carrie Champion about being on Sports Age. Look, if you need somebody, instead of making all these long phone calls to get someone there and, you know, all these logistics, you go, hey, Max is 10 minutes away, and I can go on there in a pinch. But I also want to help create stuff. In LA, they have some really cool people working there, so I think we can do some fun stuff.
Nobody's better on soccer than you. You know I'm thrilled for you. We're all really going to miss
you. I'm excited, man.
I'm thrilled that you're still with ESPN.
You're thrilled. You're thrilled because you're the last member of the 2010 class in Bristol. You were waiting for me to fade away so you could say that and you could put that on your gravestone.
You and Steve Weissman, January of 2010.
Here
me
it is.
And Don Bell, May of 2010. Sarah Walsh was a week later. And I'm the only guy, 8 years later.
He's so proud of this.
If you ask any of these executives, they go, that guy has one, like, 3-year deal. We're not going to renew.
Was there a nickname for this group? Like the Brat Pack?
The Brat Pack.
The Scat Pack. The way it's going.
With the scatological humor.
he always brought it. Who would believe it? We're the last two. I go, if I was the last one standing, they would ask for a review. I go, how the heck did this happen? Technically, I'm still standing, just on the other side.
So funny. So many great impressions, but you're a true movie lover, a true cinephile. So I want legitimate film conversation here.
Let's do it. I'm excited. I asked to be on this a while ago, and yes. I got this text from Ad, and I go, yes, I'll do it, because I've been begging to be on here. I think this show's great. If you're around your car, tell your friend to drive around. It's an easy listen.
Oh, man.
Dan and Adnan, they'll have your attention. They don't waste words. It's tremendous. These guys are really talented, so listen to it.
By the way, Max and Herc podcast going to continue.
Yeah, Herc's a little set, feels like he's a little worried. But I say we should have this podcast in L.A. because that's where we could do it. So it may have some speed bumps, but we're going to keep churning it out, and I'll work on Herc to, you know, to get out there at some point.
Good. Way too many bozos like me. If you ask him, who's your favorite actor? You always get De Niro, you always get Pacino.
Yours is number one's Pacino, right? Yeah. Okay.
You're the only person I've ever met. And I said, who's your favorite actor? Your answer is?
John Voight.
It's unbelievable. But
it should be no contest. Everyone should be saying this.
But to your point, I don't think enough people have seen Coming Home, for which he won an Academy Award. Not enough people remember Midnight Cowboy. Hoffman always gets the headline.
Yes.
Not enough people remember Deliverance.
And the Champ.
And yeah, this is going to say, you can go deep here. Why is Voight a great American actor in your opinion?
I think John Voight, and I'm not in the room, I think a lot of actors get roles and they play a certain role and they probably get offered things and go, I can't do that. And I've seen Al Pacino do it recently where he's taking those risks and I really think he's moving up there. I would put Gene Wilder near the top of the list too.
Gene Wilder, Ryan Gosling was once asked his favorite actor. He said Gene Wilder and it's not even close.
I
watched Young Frankenstein again recently. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, Peter Wilder's Sellers, great. Gene Wilder's right there. He's but when great. I look at John Voight, I just see a guy who goes, they'll say, can you do this? We want you to play, this is weird, man, John. We want you to play a Paraguayan boat captain. You're with J-Lo and Ice Cube. I'll do it! And then Anaconda.
He's paying homage to Scarface in that, right? Because he has to be playing
he's like,
the winking nods to Tony Montana.
Yeah, there's a great line when J-Lo goes, snakes don't attack people. And then he has his face, he goes, oh, no, they don't.
and he points to two scars on his face left by a snake. I just think he gets after it. Even the Ray Donovan. There is a scene where he just, it's like he always keeps me guessing. There's a scene at the end of an episode where he's done all of this, you know, illegal activity. And then at the end, he is smoking meth in a gay club with these guys dancing. I'm like, what is going on? And that's just, I love being surprised by that. And I just think he loves to be a chameleon, and I really enjoy it. I know his political views, people don't see eye to eye. If you take that out, really look at the work, I think it's fantastic.
You made that point too with Ted Nugent. You go, listen,
Ted Nugent, you're going to stop listening to that baby?
Political views are a little out there, fine, but the music is the music. Stranglehold still kicks ass.
I have to show you another Ted Nugent. Keep talking, I'll find it. I forgot this one song about Ted Nugent.
Well, you introduced me to Stranglehold, and Neil Everett is a big Nugent guy as well. He was so thrilled that I even had heard of the song before.
He was playing at New Haven, and I went down there to see, but there was a huge protest because of his gun thing, so I turned around and went home. I go, I ain't dealing with that. Sorry.
People, you know how much I love Scorsese, and you have mocked Marty because you said, you know, the movies today are way too damn long, and you go, your boy is one of the biggest reasons why. Wolf of Wall Street doesn't need to be 250. Aviator's too long. So what are your favorite filmmakers? Doesn't get enough love. John Carpenter.
Yes. People ask me what my favorite movie is, and I go, think of the movie I appreciate when it keeps coming on. It's very camp. It's Escape from New York. And I think when you look at comprehensive filmmaking, the guy does he does all the music. He composes the music on his keyboard, and he plays it. You know, Assault on Precinct 13, The Fog, Escape from New York, Halloween. And I just think it's a true talent. He kind of lost his way a bit. I think most people do. It's hard to reinvent yourself over and again. But just interesting subject matter and just very tense movie making. And he had his favorite actors a lot, obviously, you know, Adrian Barbeau, who he was married to, and then Kurt Russell and a lot of guys. So he has my undivided attention for those movies. And the music's another. Yeah. I mean, I could say that. I know he's not the most accomplished filmmaker and a guy who can weave in these storylines. But he gets you, churns them out, and you're very happy along your way. Your favorite movie maker?
Right? People don't realize, too, you grew up in Australia. What age to what age? Like 8 years?
I was 5 years old till I was 12.
So I find with your movies, you have this definite Australian influence, which I think is a big reason why you appreciate.
Absolutely.
George Miller, you appreciate, and those Mad Max movies, how great they were.
I challenge anyone. And another one, Mel Gibson, who you would question because of what he says.
Right.
If you look at him in the Road Warrior, the second Mad Max, and the Mad Max, the first one, you look at that face and you're like, what a superstar.
Yeah.
He just owns it and he's just cool. And it was so ahead of their time. So ahead of time, they made a movie like it now and it did not stick out. It was, it was ahead of. Peter Weir is another guy.
Peter Weir, Witness.
Gallipoli. It was on the other day and it's just heart wrenching. It's about the Australian effort, World War I in Gallipoli in Turkey. And how you see through these eyes, and Mel Gibson was in that movie. These Australian actors had servicemen who had no idea what they were getting into, and then very quickly they realized they were in a war. And it's just taken to that innocence when they didn't know it was going. They thought it was, hey, we're here for kind of a vacation, and then it hit them hard as a fist. But it's beautiful filmmaking, and again, Mel Gibson's weaved into all of this because he's American born, but you know, obviously Australian guy, grew up there, and was a big part of pushing that movie making. And you look now, one out of every two leading men and women are Australian. Maybe I think there's too many Australians. I mean, we got to hire American again.
I know you also appreciate Anthony Hopkins. You can appreciate English movies.
Yes, The Bounty, my favorite Anthony Hopkins movie.
How about Topsy Turvy?
Topsy Turvy, excellent.
Gilbert and Sullivan.
Caught me off surprise. I didn't think I was going to like it.
Right.
Caught me off guard. A beautiful little movie about the making of the Mikado. And what went into it? Gilbert and Sullivan, who did the Pirates of Penzance, they hit a rut. Mm-hmm. And then they were like, what are we going to do? And then they try to reinvent themselves. And they came up with this piece on Japan, the Japanese culture, which seems like a big risk, two English guys doing it. And they made a huge hit. And just seeing that process and how the actors react to it is a good look behind the curtain.
Yes.
And I think it was pretty accurate. So I really enjoyed it.
Topsy-turvy.
Jim Broadbent.
Jim Broadbent. You once pointed out to me, you said Jim Broadbent is in every
single. He's in every movie.
In every English movie.
He's a modern age Gene Hackman.
Like, who can we get? Can we get Jim Broadbent? Is Jim Broadbent available? I think we can get Broadbent.
Can we get a Jim Broadbent type? Why don't we get Jim Broadbent? Done.
Give me a little Peter O'Toole. You got to tell me, because people ask me all the time. They know how close we are. They go, hey, did Max date Charlize Theron?
No.
So here's the story of Charlize Theron. Go ahead.
Oh, wow. So I knew in Miami, we worked at a hotel, and Charlize Theron was 16, 17-year-old model, and we kind of had to keep an eye. We were in charge of – my friend Horetzi, who did that, I tagged along. We went out a couple times to bars and clubs, you know, underage, but she would experience that. Didn't see her in ages. And then she becomes big. I moved to LA and then she 2 days in the Valley. Was that?
Yeah, yeah, huge.
That really pushed her through. And then I sought her out. We remember, hey, Max. And we kind of caught up and we had a couple good stories. One great Charlize Theron story. It's not really about her. It's about me. But I had a party. We had we were watching a De La Hoya fight. I had 25 people in my crappy little apartment. And then my friend Juan Carlos, who's better friends with Charlize, who kind of like the liaison.
He's a really good looking guy, right?
He's way too good looking for his own good. So, and you know, usually I'm the best looking guy in the room and I have to take second fiddle to this guy. So anyway, Charlize calls him, goes, hey, we got two spots. It's like the big Playboy Mansion party. Do what you're doing. And my Juan Carlos comes to me and goes, hey, got to get rid of everyone. Playboy. He was my roommate then. He goes, Playboy party. I go, I can't. Everyone's here. The fight hasn't even started. He goes, what do you want to do? He's looking at me. I'm going. I go, all right, all right, all right. So I go there. I pull the cable out of the box. Hey, the fight's gone. Everyone. And they're like, no, they saw me pull it out. I go, I'm kidding. Everybody out. I go, why do we have to leave? I go, everyone out. And I finally fessed up. And they're like, okay, why don't you say that in the first place?
Right, people are understanding. Sure.
Had a great time. Played Frogger with Jeffrey Rush. I was yelling at a guy with Jack Nicholson because a guy took a photo of him in a position, you know, probably didn't want that out. And he goes, what are you doing? I go, you can't do that. Yeah. I go, hey, Mr. Nicholson, you want me to get that camera? He goes, ah, that's fine. Let him have his fun.
Nice. Nicholson's awesome.
I saw one ESPN, former ESPN employee, slightly oversurfed. We won't get into that.
Yeah, you can tell him off camera.
Just really quickly, I may have missed the beginning of that story. You dated Charlize Theron?
No, I did not. No. People said that because I knew her.
Correct.
And she's been very supportive. I haven't talked to her in ages, quite frankly. But if I did, I've seen her a couple times here and there. And it all comes back. But I've known her for 25 years.
Got it. And
I haven't seen her the last
her.
5 or 6.
Cool.
Yeah.
You
no, 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 no.
Cool.
Got it. Say what you want. Thank you. It's so much easier to say that. Trust me. And get me some cred.
When Max is now back in LA, and if Charlize Theron was there, he walked over, she would immediately, Max, how are you?
Yes.
Great to see you. And so
I knew her mom very well because they were South African. So I talked to her mom about cricket. You know, Australia, South Africa, and then...
Give me a South African accent, because I think it's a tough
Before one. You do that, have you seen Atomic Blonde?
No.
All right.
I will not. Do you like it?
No, there's a good action sequence.
Great action sequence on the staircase.
I heard you talking about it.
Give me South African. It's like South African.
Right. There's a great South African movie out there. It's called Stander. It's about the corruption of the South African soul. Would you please stop laughing? What was the movie with Morgan Freeman? Invictus. What a pile of garbage that was. No one likes Nelson Mandela any more than I do. He is a legend. He is a hero to this country. But that movie was
a little bit of Gary Player in there.
Oh, Gary Player. Listen, Gary Player, this is how you do it. Look, so many times I'm watching the Masters and these people are hitting, bring out their wedge. They're right on the crust of the green. Just butt it on there. Just save yourself a stroke at the very least. You just don't do that. And kids, are you listening? Kids, don't eat junk food. It's bad for you. And the Coca-Colas are very bad.
Two more. I want you to tell me the Connery story when your buddy saw him. And then I want you to close with the Richard Burton, Liz Taylor. You know what I'm talking about. Give the Connery story first. The Burton one, you know. Give the Connery
story. All right. Okay, so we're at this really crappy golf course in L.A. And it's like a 9-hole, I think. And then my friend is there, and he's like, he sees it. He goes, oh, my God. I go, what? I go, it's Sean Connery. And I go, no way. Oh, my God, it's Sean Connery. He's about 40 yards away from us, just practicing by himself. And then my friend is, I got to go say something. I go, Nanny! I go, he's by himself for a reason. He probably wants to do a quick 9-hole. And then my friend goes, oh, you're right. So a couple beats go by, and my friend goes, you know what? I got to go say. I'm like, all right. So I get creeped. I move up because I know this is going to end badly. So my friend goes, I'm going to give him the Zardoz line. He won't say that. And he goes, Sir Sean Connery. And you already see him startled. I'm like, oh, shoot. And then he goes, hey, I'm the biggest fan of you. I mean, I've seen every one of your movies. I've even seen Zardoz. And I see Sean Connery still practicing his swing. And I go, looks up to my friend and says the following.
I'd appreciate it if you respect my right to privacy.
That was followed by me falling on my back, throwing a 3-wood because I was teeing off. I told you!
I'd appreciate. He said it was very paced. I will punch you in the stomach
Best movie clips ever. You showed me the Richard Burton, one of the all time classics.
Yes,
the Connery you get the most love for, but I contend this. The best impression you do is Richard Burton.
Right.
If anybody knew Richard Burton, they know that era of acting, and you called someone as Richard Burton, they think
I played Hamlet at the Grove. I played Hamlet at the Globe. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune and by opposing end them. To die, to sleep. To sleep, perchance to dream. That is the question. That is the question. Wales forever.
The Burton is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And tell me about the interview with him and Elizabeth
Taylor. There was this BBC show. This is, again, I fell out of my chair laughing. Elizabeth Taylor is going on, and they're talking about, you know, her marriage to Richard Burton. And this is how you can tell he's such a good actor and a good listener. She goes, first of all, I mean, being with Richard's incredible. We get to work together in The Taming of the Shrew. And one thing is to work with him, but to be married to one of the greatest actors of all time is incredible. And then Richard Burton goes, one of?
Yes. Just busted.
I got to find that special. I want to watch it again for that line because I was so, it was so incredible. One of?
This is incredible.
So arrogant. So arrogant.
I knew we would be friends. One of the first sports centers we did together, it was Brian McCann at home run. And I said, do the can. And you go, please, no more Moulin Rouge references. You knew it right away. Didn't miss a beat.
And then you also, the other one, remember, you went, 100 pence. 6 pence, none the richer. And I go, why don't you just get rid of it? Why don't you say, Hunter, 6 pence, none the richer. Save yourself a word or two. Or better yet, don't use that ever again.
I remember the first show we did together. Within minutes, you're like, Bangladeshi? I go, no, I found this back.
I did that to get a rise.
Right. And then on the air, you sit here alongside Toronto Argonauts season ticket holder. It's like my first time on ESPN.
And then that just moved you right
to the top. No, but I remember afterwards, like as a big brother, you're like, hey, man, I think you're really good. You go a little quick. He goes, but I like your energy.
Did I say that to you?
Yeah. It was our first show. Yeah. This was literally my first 3-hour show. And you go, no, I think you're pretty good, man. He goes, quick. He goes, but I like your energy.
Can I say a little quick? You don't forget anything, do you?
Yeah. He goes, a little quick. He goes, but good energy. And I like your man.
Smells like whiskey. A little quick.
But I think I dragged you to my level a bit, which is a dangerous place to be if you're here.
We would get in trouble because they go, listen, when you and Max are together, I go, what does that mean? They go,
you want to tell that story? We have time?
Sure. Go ahead.
So there's this article, I think, on Awful Announcing, and it said, Max Brawls, Adnan Virk, this pairing's great. I mean, they're fun and that. And then we said, we hadn't worked together in like 6 months. We hadn't worked there. So we bring it to the talent office and go, hey, this article, you see it? Great. Didn't work together again for another year and a half. They basically saw that. No, it's not happening.
I asked Ben Koo, who runs Awful Announcing, do you remember the headline was the most unlikely sports center duo ever? Because we were doing
They're giving us a push, and
they go, these guys are terrific. They got great chemistry. They're really funny. We've never seen them before because we were always on ESPN News. So it was a rare time someone saw us. And they go, no, you guys had way too much fun.
We shan't be having any of that.
We got to stomp that out of here. M. Brett Oss, ESPN, Max and Herc podcast.
Oh, and Instagram. Instagram. I do a lot of risque photos for anyone who's interested. And, just repost a lot of stuff that aired on.
Maybe Peter Toole to close, which is another good one you do. He's always drunk in his movies.
He's always drunk. West End. That sounds so much like Richard Patton. If you think I'm overserved, wait till you see Oliver Reed. He just left the bar moments before taking the stage.
Peter O'Toole and Venus. Like, it's just, why did he get nominated for them? He's just playing Peter O'Toole.
He didn't look so hot at the end.
Max Brodos, always hot. Thanks, brother.
And now, a thought from Geico Motorcycle. It took 15 minutes to click on the banner ad entitled, "You Won't Believe What These Child Stars Look Like Now." Be dissatisfied and kind of sad about how the child stars look. And now your computer is plagued by incessant pop-up ads.
Oh, this can't be good.
To add insult to injury, you could have used those 15 clickbait minutes to switch your motorcycle insurance to Geico. Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on motorcycle insurance.
All right. Thanks so much to Max. He's a phenomenal guy. And obviously, I'll be in touch with him. And he's a real supporter of Cinephile. So I really appreciate him hanging out with us for a little bit. And all those impressions. So good. All right. The shorts. Best animated short. Rick Passmore, devoted cinephile, goes out to Hartford here. They were showing. This is the big thing, too. Big shout out to Shania Norman, who hooked me up with all these shorts. I remember years past, I wouldn't know where to find these movies. Now you know. shorts.tv/theoscarshorts/theatrical-release. Once again, shorts.tv/theoscarshorts/theatrical-release. That's where you can find out, hey, where are these shorts all showing? You can find them on the big screen. So we start out first with the animated movies. Four of the five I liked a ton. The one that I probably liked the least was Rick Passmore's favorite, Garden Party.
Hilarious. Right up my alley with the dark humor. Definitely see the turn coming, but when it hits you, you're either in hysterics or you're disgusted. So I imagine you were the latter, Adnan. However, we're getting to a point with computer animation that it's getting extremely realistic to the point when we see it in a live action film and it's really poor, we really call it out. And all of these films are tremendous with their detail, especially the CG ones.
Yeah.
But with something with Garden Party, it's about these frogs that have taken over a mansion.
I'll give you the plot before I jump you. A luxurious villa and its grounds have become home to amorous, hungry, and accident-prone frogs and toads. While they enjoy the bounties on offer, including caviar and macaroons, the amphibians uncover the whereabouts of the villa's owner.
And when you're looking around and you see the frogs are jumping on windows and the dirt on the windows and the frogs' footprints are their paw prints or whatever prints you have with a frog are staying with on the window as it's climbing up in this dust. Very, very subtle changes within the dynamic of the tint of the window from the dust.
Yeah.
And like going through the sound design, because there's not a lick of dialogue in it. The sound design is tremendous. And like I said, when I'm not going to give it away just because when you hit the turn, I think everyone should see it. It's either going to repulse you or you're going to be losing your mind laughing like I was in the group of friends I have that went with us to see it. We all thought it was probably, if it wasn't the best, it was the second best of the animated shorts. And it's a four Maple Leaf animated short.
Listen, most people are going to be disgusted. Let's be honest.
I found it repulsive.
At the turn, you're going to be disgusted. It's visually brilliant. And the sound is the first thing I notice. As Rick said, the sound is every detail, everything you see, it has the perfect sound to it. It's amazing. But I enjoyed it and was disgusted. And most people will be disgusted too.
Dear Basketball is probably going to win. Kobe Bryant's going to win an Academy Award. It's only 4.5 minutes. John Williams' score, which is unbelievable. John Williams has been nominated like 52 times. That's not an exaggeration. That's not hyperbole. He's been nominated 52 times, and he does the score for Dear Basketball. It's listed here at 6 minutes. Maybe it's 5.5 with the credits as well. But it's literally just a poem of Kobe Bryant, and it's drawn to life by veteran animation director Glenn Keane. I liked it. Thought it was very good. I don't know if I watched it, Dan, and said, well, that's going to win an Oscar. But at the hell, it's Kobe.
Yeah, I think his voice, because he narrates it too, I think his voice and stature really elevated it in terms of everyone viewing it and thinking it was very good. I like the use of color. You only see color when it's the jerseys. I thought that was nice. The music, as you mentioned, is a great tone setter by John Williams. I mean, I guess it's probably the front runner to win. I don't know if it was my favorite. I'm a big Kobe guy.
Right.
But if he does win, am I supposed to ask him about the Me Too movement?
Yeah, you are going to be there. You're going to be in the media room. You're going to be the only guy that only go get this guy here. I'm like, what do you mean? He has a credential. He can ask about it. Kobe can say no comment. It's fine. We all remember what happened in Colorado. If you do it, that would be tremendous. Do you basketball, Ricky?
As friend of the show, Scott Feinberg, you tweeted out, he has that tremendous interview with Willem Dafoe on his show, so kind of cross-promotion there, sorry.
Nice. No, the best question he asked him, he said, do you think Marty was influenced to cast you as Jesus Christ in Last Temptation of Christ after the death-like scene in Platoon? And Dafoe said, I don't know, that's a good question. He goes, all I know is they went through a lot of people. Aidan Quinn was originally going to play Jesus, and then, of course, funding was taken away because of, you know, all this other stuff, but... Yes, Scotty did a great job with Dafoe. And Feinberg, big on the Criterion Collection. You're all over the 50% off. You bought like 20 DVDs. Good for him.
But back on that, his guest before, there's a documentarian. I forget his name off the top of my head. But he asked about the influence of documentary films and how New York, L.A. really plays into that. And L.A. being obviously where Kobe played his entire career and they were getting a lot of push. That might be the reason why it wins, is because it has an actual affection of Los Angeles, where a majority of the Oscar voters do live.
Yeah.
So while it may not be the best short, it's probably going to win. And it really was. I give it 3.5. I believe it's all hand-drawn, so it's old-school animation, a la Beauty and the Beast, which Keane did direct before, which was the first animated film to be nominated for Best Picture back in 92. So that really broke molds there. So you have that little bit of legacy going on with Dear Basketball. So it gives it that boost, but probably the number three or number four best short of the five.
I like Negative Space a lot. I'm always a good sucker for a good father and son story. Very sweet story about Sam's father, hardly ever at home. He's often away on business trips, so he's able to connect with his son by teaching him how to pack a suitcase. 5-minute anime short, very nicely done. Revolting Rhymes is the longest one. It's almost 30 minutes. It's the wolf from the fairy tale Little Red Riding Hood telling true and twisted stories of adventures involving Snow White, Cinderella, and Jack. The film based on the much-loved rhymes written by Roald Dahl, who's clearly a very demented guy. I liked it, but I can't see it winning the Academy Award. Sometimes it's just a little bit irreverent is probably the right word I'm looking for. But I did enjoy it. I thought it was fun. So those are the five there. Dan or Rick, any thoughts on those other three?
You skipped right over Lou, Disney Pixar. Lou. I thought sweet you were movie. A company man.
Lost and Found. Awesome. A very sweet story.
Schoolyard bully.
Yes. Gets his comeuppance. Typical Pixar. Very sweet. Very well done. Live action shorts. Again. I think they cut to the chase at a pretty good pace. I mean, this is the thing. You don't have much time with these things. I did a goldderby.com. You check out, I did a Google Hangout with Tom O'Neill and Chris Beecham. And Tom O'Neill, who runs the site, he thought a lot of these were pretty weak. But I said, well, the one that's the favorite to win is DeKalb Elementary, which is about a mentally unstable guy. I didn't think that was particularly strong. He's holding a woman captive. Obviously, school shootings are very much in a hot topic right now and for good reason. But there just wasn't much meat on the bone here. I know it's a live action short. It's 21 minutes, but there wasn't a whole lot to it. The two that I really liked that stood out for me, one is the 11 o'clock, which I thought, that's my favorite of the five. A psychiatrist earnestly tries to help his delusional patient, but his efforts are complicated by the fact the patient believes himself to be the doctor, with each trying to out-analyze the other. The session spirals out of control. Australian film. Perfect for a short. 12 minutes. It's funny. It's clever. Good twist. I'm like, that's exactly what I'm looking for in a good short.
I told my friends after the screening, I may have even said it during the screening when the credits were rolling. I said, this is what happens when an intelligent person or a scholar rewrites Who's on First. It's essentially what it was. It was a retelling of the classic Abbott and Costello bit Who's on First. It's snap-neck dialogue, keeps going back and forth. The whole question and answer, the word association game they play with each other. We're just dying because it's just constantly going and we're losing it laughing.
If you want my notes, the 11 o'clock, a psychiatrist meets with a patient who thinks he's a psychiatrist. Some elements of Who's on First.
Yes, it was in the notes as well. And the one I really loved a lot, too, probably my second favorite, was The Silent Child. Libby, a profoundly deaf 4-year-old, the youngest child in a family, all hearing, unable to communicate but about to start school. Libby's assigned a social worker who teaches her sign language. Libby's skeptical parents are reluctant to be involved, however, and pose a potential block to Libby's education. I thought it was really beautifully done. The scroll in particular is very powerful, talking about how many children are hard of hearing and don't get the support and the education that they need. And if they don't get that support, things oftentimes become very awry for them, and the importance of sign language. And the parents are just saying, well, just teach her to talk. I mean, just, you know, whatever the counseling is. It's like, well, no, like, she may never talk again. This is why sign language is so critical. And if you learn sign language, she can live a wonderful life. She can do anything that any person who does not have this ailment can do, but the parents just don't seem to understand that. So that's not only, I thought, a really good film, but a very important film as well. So that one I really enjoyed as well. The other one I thought was okay, Watuwate, All of Us, The Hijacking on the Bus, and My Nephew Emmett. They were both fine. Didn't think particularly exemplary. Last one of the shorts to discuss, the best documentary shorts. Of the three categories of shorts, I thought these ones were the most mixed bag. I thought the animations were really strong, live action pretty good. These ones either really good or really like, huh? And I asked Tom O'Neill and Chris Beecham, how do they on Gold Derby recognize who the favorites are? Because Edith and Eddie is the favorite. And I said, I didn't think it was very strong. It's about a 96-year-old Edith Hill, 95-year-old Eddie Harrison, married, unconcerned. One is African-American, the other is white. The newlyweds are forced apart, however, when one of Edith's daughters, unhappy about the relationship, forces her mother to leave her Virginia home and move to Florida. Tom was hilarious. He goes, God, because it takes forever to get to the point, huh? I said, it's only 40 minutes. It's from Laura Checkaway, who apparently, as Chris Beecham told me, has been very active on the campaign circuit. He goes, normally, these directors or producers that do the shorts, you don't really see them getting much pub. He goes, but she's been everywhere. He goes, if you wanted her for an hour on Cinephile, she'd be like, whatever you need. Like, if it was a third grader in Anchorage, you're like, sure, whatever you guys need. So he goes, listen, a lot of this is just campaigning. And I've seen Laura everywhere. And Edith Eddy is about interracial marriage. And it's about a couple of old people. And it's sweet. And so he goes, I think that's the one that's going to win. And I said, well, I didn't think it was a very good documentary. He's like, yeah, but that really doesn't matter sometimes. The one that I love is Heaven is a Traffic Jam on the 405. Speaking of L.A., Tom and Chris both pointed out some voters will just see 405 and vote for that. Like, all right, L.A., great. I look for and Tom, again, his issue with this one is it takes too long to get to the point. It's 40 minutes. And at about the 20-25 minute mark, okay, I get what this is about now. And the tagline of the movie says, her art saved her life. He goes, it's too long to get to that point. I disagree with him. I thought it was great from start to finish. But it's a great title, which he agreed. Heaven is a traffic jam on the 405. Frank Stiefel is the director. Artist Mindy Alper has spent almost all of her 56 years combating severe depression and anxiety, using medication, electroconvulsive therapy, and psychiatry to help her. Art has always been her most effective outlet, with drawing and sculpture offering the tools to give voice to her fears and mental battles. That theme is one that I love. Crumb is my favorite documentary, and that's, again, about a guy who seems to find art to be therapeutic. That's his outlet amidst dealing with tremendous family dysfunction. And in this case, Mindy is the one who is specifically dealing with all these issues. One of the first opening scenes, she shows you all the different pills she's taking. I mean, your heart goes out to her. This person's clearly very damaged. Her speech is very slow and deliberate. But then later the film reveals that she's actually made a really strong living as an artist. When you find out the upbringing she had and the tyrannical father she had, my heart goes out to her. And I thought it was a really powerful film. And to me, again, that's a good documentary short. Slice of life told in short form. I thought it was excellent. Those guys told me the winner's either going to be Edith Reddy, probably, but maybe Heaven is a traffic jam on the 405. So of those lesser categories, so to speak, I would be thrilled if she ends up winning. Heroin, I thought, was fine. Mark Simon, a big fan of. I think it might be on Netflix. It's about hunting in West Virginia, overdoses from heroin. I thought it was okay. Obviously, very timely topic with all the issues about drugs right now affecting smaller communities. Knife Skills was interesting. This is about a restaurateur in Cleveland. Shout out to Ohio Passmore, who staffs his restaurant primarily with men and women recently released from prison. And he gives them 6 weeks to learn the skills that will better their lives, propel the new venture to success. This is what I'm sure Michael Moore would love, because he's often talks about, you know, the prison system and how it's just overwhelmed and it's not actually helping to rehabilitate people. And so I thought Knife Skills was very interesting. The fact that these people released, they give them a crash course, and you see these inmates, guys who went to prison for aggravated assault or whatever it was. And he's like, oh, yeah, my mom used to always cook. I've always kind of liked cooking. Great. And all of a sudden you see the guy is like a sous chef. Like it's a wonderful story. And I think that one's very powerful. And then Traffic Stop as well. Traffic Stop is on HBO. I saw that on HBO Go. This is unbelievable. Like it brings to mind the Rodney King video. 26-year-old African-American elementary school teacher Breon King pulled over by a white police officer for a routine traffic stop. The incident escalated into a violent arrest, followed by a conversation about race in America between King and another white officer. It is jarring when you see the video of her and what this guy, it's just manhandles her. And it's unfortunate and troubling that there hasn't been much resolution to it. I'm watching the documentary. She gets caught for speeding. Okay, fine. And she's not resisting arrest. She's just kind of just, you know, being a little bit standoffish. And the guy just grabs her and throws her to the ground. Like, oh my God. Like, thank God this was caught on video so people could do this. And yet, he's still a cop. He's still working in Florida. Like, it's unbelievable these things happen. And then that conversation she has with the other white police officer. She says, oh, do you think there's racist cops? He goes, well, yeah. She goes, well, how do you know who the racist cops are, the ones who are not? He's like, well, I think it goes both ways. I think the black community doesn't like white police officers. And they start going back and forth a little bit. So it was an interesting dialogue just about race in America. And obviously, that issue of police brutality is one that is very important and one that people will continue to talk about. Those are all the shorts. Once again, thanks to Shania for hooking me up. Live action, documentary, and animation.
He's just an average man with an average life. And his reviews dictate that.
Oh, right up my alley, first and foremost. Playing to my strengths.
Dan Stanzik is.
I thought it was a little much.
Every man.
By the way, that is from your review of Three Billboards, talking about Sam Rockwell. I thought it was a little much.
Yeah, I don't know. Randy, I don't know if I like that.
I think he's
open.
Mocking
I think
you.
He's mocking me, yeah.
Colbert had Rockwell on last night, and he asked him about that. He said, listen, there's some backlash here. The fact your character is a virulent racist. He's like, uh-huh. And he goes, in the ending of Three Billboards, he feels like he's redeemed. Like, people are like, what the hell? This guy's brutal. And so Rockwell goes, listen, I don't think he's redeemed. He goes, that last shot, him and McDormand in the car, he goes, they're about to go do something else bad. So it's not like all of a sudden he's seen the light. And it's not like he's a hero of the character. He's, you know, I don't feel like he's redeemed at the end of the movie. Colbert's like, all right, just throwing it out there. If Three Billboards doesn't win Best Picture, that's probably the biggest reason why people don't like his character in that ending, which you mentioned there in your opening.
And he's still going to win for Best Supporting.
That is a lock. He's going to win for supporting, yeah.
Okay, so the premise of this is what?
So you are the everyman of the podcast. So when I get highfalutin talking about live action shorts and Passmore starts talking about animation and how great Loving Vincent is, you're the one who's going to tell us about Enemy of the State and why that film should have won Best.
Okay,
Picture.
I don't know if I picked the right movie to start this segment with, but here we go.
This doesn't feel like The Great Outdoors, but I want something that people can appreciate.
Midnight in Paris was written and directed by Woody Allen, who has something of a sordid past that's being revisited in the wake of the Me Too movement. But as the everyman, I am able to separate the art from the artist.
Okay.
This movie was thought to be a light, breezy, surface-level comedy starring Owen Wilson, something of an everyman himself.
That is an excellent way of saying it. Owen Wilson has a busted-up nose. He is not leading man quality, but he's a good actor.
But it is actually a sensible, layered social commentary with a timeless message about nostalgia. Owen Wilson plays a successful Hollywood screenwriter trying to rework his first novel while spending time in Paris with his fiance, played by Rachel McAdams. Every evening, Wilson walks the streets of the City of Light, and shortly after midnight, gets called into an antique car and transported back in time to the 1920s. There, he meets and speaks with the likes of Zelda and F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, Pablo Picasso, Cole Porter, Salvador Dali, T.S. Eliot, and even gets Gertrude Stein to read his manuscript.
Listen, you had me at Gertrude Stein. Go ahead.
Kathy Bates, I'm pretty sure. Right?
Kathy Bates, awesome.
Wilson's character is mesmerized by this alternate reality. He deems Paris in the 1920s to be the golden age of art, and he soon falls hard for Picasso's mistress, played by the sultry Marion Cotillard.
Good use of sultry.
Who stands out from among the standout cast. One night, as the two of them are strolling through the streets, they are beckoned to a carriage and transported to the late 1890s. It's like a scene out of Inception, which is particularly reminiscent because of Cotillard. Her character is obsessed with Paris at the turn of the century. To her, that's the golden age. They end up at a party among the famous artists of that era, like Gauguin and Degas, and as Wilson tries to convince Cotillard to go back to the 20s, he realizes what most of us don't. Nostalgia is just the denial of the painful present. The notion that someone was born too late or that someone would be happier in the past is an illusion. We glorify the past and talk about golden ages, but no one remembers or points out the bad stuff. Living in a simpler time may seem romantic, but how would you handle life without cell phones and the internet? This, right now, is the time we live in. Everyone thinks the present is dull and a little unsatisfying, but in 20 years, we'll all look back and truly appreciate the mountain of great art that was produced, and hopefully this movie is close to the summit.
Yeah, all right, The Everyman, Midnight in Paris. Hemingway, unbelievable in the movie. Who wants to fight? That guy's awesome. I want to find out who that actor is. We got to get him on Cinephile. Very well done. So Midnight in Paris, a movie, listen, very much fitting with the Dan Stanzik aesthetic. You're a writer. It's about a writer. You love the 1920s. You're a big fan of the jazz era. I could see you loving Picasso. Like that. Look, what era would you like to revisit?
None. Like that, I think that's my point, is that everyone thinks it'd be cooler to live way back when.
Right.
I'm such a present day guy. Like,
was everyone in the future then?
No, I mean, maybe.
So you're either present or future. You would never want to go backwards.
Never.
Because I would always have loved to have been alive in the 70s, just for Marty. Like, I just want to be able to watch this movie. But you're right. I mean, like, race relations for a guy like me in 1976, not as strong as 2018. Good stuff there. That is The Everyman, Dan Stanzik. Midnight in Paris, which I'm sure is available on HBO, Netflix. Check it out. If you've never seen it, he's right. It's an excellent movie. Now with Woody Allen, the Me Too movement, I don't know if people don't want to revisit his films, but it is an excellent film. And it would involve basically a rebirth for Woody because he obviously had such success early in his career with Annie Hall Manhattan,
won the Oscar. Yeah.
For a screenplay, which he hadn't done in a long time. That is The Everyman. All right, thanks so much for listening to Cinephile. Like I said, the next time we will be talking to all of you, Dan and I will be at the Kodak Theater. We'll have walked the red carpet. Our man Ben Lyon's going to hook us up. All my predictions, goldderby.com. Go to Experts Picks. As my friend Max Bredos was just asking me off air, what's going to win Best Picture? It's either going to be Shape of Water or Three Billboards. Nobody dislikes Shape of Water. They're saying it's probably about number two or number three in their rankings. And for Three Billboards, either people love it or they're polarizing and they don't like the fact Rockwell's character gets somewhat redeemed. But I will predict Three Billboards wins Best Picture because it won the Screen Actors Guild Award and it won the BAFTA, which is something, there's nothing British about Three Billboards. If a movie about middle America is winning the BAFTA, then I feel like it's got enough momentum to win Best Picture. Shape of Water will win for director, it'll win for score, and those other categories. A very good analogy or comparison Chris Beecham made of Gold Derby because it's kind of like Life of Pi. Life of Pi won for director Ang Lee, it won for other minor categories, but Best Picture did not win. That's what I foresee happening. Three Billboards wins picture, Del Toro wins director, absolute lock, and the acting category is very straightforward. McDormand, Ullman, Rockwell, Janney. Original screenplay is a fun one. If you want a fun category, because it looked like Lady Bird, now it's not going to be Lady Bird. Three Billboards, it's going to win Best Picture, McDonough's going to win, and he wasn't nominated for director. But Get Out won the Writers Guild Award, and Get Out might win for Best Original Screenplay. The one award it'll win, Jordan Peele. That's one of the tightest races going right now. Adapted Screenplay is a fait accompli. James Ivory for Call Me By Your Name. Thanks, as always, to listening to Cinephile. We'll see you next time at the movies.
Don't miss out on the next episode of Cinephile. Subscribe to the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast by clicking the Listen tab in the ESPN app.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.